Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
The color had been sucked from everything, and not just the dead. The sky, about to drop new snow, had clouded into charcoal, rubbing away the horizon. Both ends of the two-lane country road narrowed into a ragged ribbon by the jumble of dark official vehicles. It disappeared into the gauze of gray mist rising from the sudden melt, unusual for late January. It was what the melt had revealed. A mud-splattered red ambulance idled low in the center of the rough stone bridge that crossed the Devil's Creek. 50 people milled about, cops in blue uniforms and ball caps, others in suits and dark trenches, television cuties in clingy coats and cameramen in cargo jackets and big pocket pants, and a few print reporters. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Jack Fredrickson, author of The Black Cage, the first in a mystery series about a disgraced crime reporter who has been relegated to writing about small town events after being framed in what seemed to be an inappropriate relationship with a grieving widow. But Milo Riggs is himself a devastated widower after his wife was killed in a random drive-by shooting, and he's just trying to get by. Hi, Jack. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
So let's start with you telling me, what led you to becoming a mystery writer in the first place?
Normally, I'm asked it the way is, what on earth led you to believe you could write mystery novels? But I had no intention of becoming a mystery writer or a writer of any sort. I'd written a couple of business books in the 80s. But in the beginning of the new century, I owned and managed an office furnishings firm. And I had about 15, 18 employees. And I had one salesperson, my best salesperson, that drove me insane. He enraged me by the chances he took with my money. But nonetheless, we got along pretty well. But we had a big blow up one afternoon late. And he was taking a very risky order. And I wasn't sure these people were going to be able to pay. And it was a large order. And so we were arguing, and I was so flummoxed by this guy, so furious, that he stormed out, and I realized I couldn't just go home enraged as I was. So I sat down at our reception station, and back then we had a typewriter, an electric typewriter, and I started describing what it would be like to witness the roof of a house blowing off. And I could see the scene. It was kind of an Oak Brook kind of gated community house. And I thought, you know, if I just describe that, let's see what I can do. Now, this was my very, very first attempt at fiction ever. So I sat down and I spent about an hour, maybe typing three or four pages of this old woman teaching a bunch of kids about planting flowers at the gate of this gated community. And it calmed me. It calmed me wonderfully. I went home. I didn't tell my lovely wife or my kids what I was up to. But all the next day, I kept thinking about what fun it was and what calmness I got from doing this the previous evening. So I couldn't wait for the last of my employees to get out of there so I could do this again. Well, one thing led to another. one set of words led to another, and I kept at it every evening. I told no one. I locked up my pages. It was garbage writing, but it was great fun and something brand new. And at the end of probably a year, maybe I don't remember exactly, but maybe 10 months, maybe 14 months in there, I had a full-length novel manuscript. I didn't know what to do with that, so I threw it in the drawer and I tried to forget about the process of writing. So anyway, I kept at that a little bit, looking at the pages furtively, but that got me started.
Wow. Did that turn out to be the first mystery?
It did, but I finally fessed up to a friend of mine what I'd done. And what he said was, well, let's take a short story class at the College of DuPage. Because he was interested in maybe doing something. I thought, yeah, that's great. So he and I signed up for this class. We eat, you know, it was like a, I don't know, maybe a 10-page short story was the objective of each of the students. And when you got done with it, you passed it around. You made copies for everybody in the class, and they wrote their comments. My favorite comment was, and these are anonymous comments, but, "Dear Jack, your story was my absolute favorite of all the stories in the class, but I have no idea what it's about." And so anyway, I looked at that and, and I thought, well, you know, I looked at it and I thought, yeah, that's probably true. Then I happened to be sitting on my patio and my daughter, who does write, came walking up and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "You know, I'm just trying to write to become a better reader," which was the way I could rationalize what I was doing. She said, "Well, let me see what you've got there." And I had my confusing story. So she took it. Took her about 5 minutes to read the thing. She said, "Look, this is a real cheesy ending, and there's this, and then there's that, you know." And she had a list of complaints, handed it back to me, and went on her way. I took her criticisms to heart. I redid the story, and on the following New Year's Eve, it was frigid. I walked down to the post office, only about 4 blocks away, freezing. Did not tell my wife where I was going. Dropped the story, which I had called The Brick Thing, in the mail to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. Lo and behold, on April Fool's Day following, they accepted it.
Wow.
Now, all of a sudden, hey. So out came the novel from the drawer because, hey, I'm going to be published, you know. And so I took that novel out. And I looked at it again. I reworked it again. I then went to the Iowa Summer Writing Festival and took a class taught by a woman who I was told would read whole manuscripts. And so I, first night of class, I handed this monstrosity to her. And I said, "Take a look." She read the whole thing that night after class. And we're talking maybe the class ended at 9 o'clock on that first night. And she met with me the following Thursday and said, "I think you ought to send it out to some agents." And so, well, you know, okay. But anyway, I did send up the first pages to St. Martin's Macmillan and they bought it. So lo and behold, that's how I got into the game.
What a great story.
Isn't that great?
Just want to clarify, you said like an Oak Brook gated home. Yeah. I've only been to that community once, but it's a very wealthy suburb.
Yes,
west of
it is. Very okay. Wealthy, you know, multi-million dollar homes. And
with a
and
big gate. Mall.
Pardon me?
With a big mall.
With a big, yeah. With a big, yeah, a big mall okay. That funds everything, yes.
Okay, which is closed now, as is everything. So you ended up writing 7 books in the Deck Elstrom series. You won awards.
Yes.
And then you also wrote 1 standalone book, right?
Yes.
So why did you decide to start a whole new series starring Milo or Milo?
Milo.
Rig. Milo Rig.
Milo Rig. I had actually written, I was fooling around with the concept of writing a different character and writing about a different character, one who's involved in the deteriorating print news biz. And I started fooling around with a character. The Deck Elstrom series is a humorous series. I mean, I play very straight about it being whodunits. Okay, I want to satisfy the traditional demanding mystery novel reader. But I use humor in them, maybe in part to disguise the fact that I don't know anything about plot. But I've peopled the Deck Elstrom character. I've surrounded him with an oddball ensemble, okay, for some comic relief. And so, but because I want to play with the notion of making someone laugh and then grounding them with something that's not humorous. So I'm playing with the reader a little bit. And those have been doing very well, well enough for me. But the Milo Rig series is a more serious series. The first Milo Rig book, the one we're talking about, The Black Cage, is dealing with what I consider to be a hugely serious topic, which is trouble in newspaper land. And I wanted to play with that. I also wanted to base it in part on crimes that had happened in Chicagoland in the 50s, but I didn't want to make it a period book. So I decided to go with something darker. Now, this is 5 years ago. I sent some pages off to my publisher, Severn House in England now, because they get me into Europe. And they said, we're delighted with this, but we want you to continue the Deck Elstrom stuff. And we'd like you to do 2 books a year. I agonize too much and I can't do 2 books a year. I don't have the chops for it. I write and I rewrite and I rewrite again. I agonize over every paragraph. And so because of that, I have to, it takes me a year to do a book. And so because of that, this one came out interrupting the Deck Elstrom series. And so I guess I'll probably be having a go at both of them, one each every other year.
But tell us, how did you actually start The Black Cage?
I think I started by noodling around with a murder, actually 2 murders that happened in and 2 girls disappeared, teenagers, disappeared in on December 26th of 1956. They were not found. They disappeared in Chicago after going to see an Elvis Presley movie, Love Me Tender. And they were found on January 22nd. Miles away from their home, and they were found with no known cause of death. One had been strewn on top of the other. Now, this was a very frightening thing in January of 1957, 2 parents in Chicagoland, because it followed closely the murders of the Schussler-Peterson boys in October of 1955. 3 boys were found, not after such a long delay. They were found after a day, a couple of days, in a field. And it was a real deal-changing couple of events for parents, in Chicago. So I started fooling with the girls' murders just to see, which have never been officially solved, okay? And so I started fooling around with that crime and started thinking, how could I build something out of this and meld it in with what's going on in newspaper land.
Mm-hmm. You were born here in Chicago, right?
Yes.
And now you live in the western suburbs. I'm wondering if you live near the same suburb where in which one of your characters has a fabulous estate. And can we talk about those fabulous estates?
Yeah, sure. We can talk about them. I don't really have firsthand knowledge about living fabulously. but yeah, I am, you know, the town where I live and the, you know, it is surrounded by a lot of dough, you know, and Oak Brook, as we mentioned, is a very wealthy suburb.
Oh, that's by you too.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Oak Brook is, yeah, no, I among other things, I play tennis poorly, but I play tennis at the Oak Brook Park District tennis courts. And So I go right past a lot of dough to get there. You know, and so there's a lot of affluence there. So it's a great place to, it's Chicago offers enough interesting pockets to where Chicago is truly, Chicagoland is truly a great character in each of my books.
Mm-hmm. Where do you come up with your rather unusual names like Deck Elstrom, Milo Rigg, Jerome Glett, etc.?
You know, well, Deck Elstrom, my grandmother, an odd woman, had a lover, and his name was Vlodek, V-L-O-D-E-K. And it would be an odd name to give to any child. But nonetheless, I remember this guy because I met him a couple of times. He looked like a little troll. I don't think he was 5 feet tall. And he was completely bald. And he had like this wizened little face. And I found him to be frightening. But anyway, I thought, well, that would be an interesting first name if we could make it Deck. But play off the fact that it really is Vlodek, which is the Bohemian pronunciation. Elstrom, I am a hybrid, and I am a quarter Norwegian, half Bohemian, and a quarter Swede, which causes, I guess, great turmoil. But the Norwegian name Elstrom is one of my family names going way back. So I decided to meld the two, much as I am kind of a combination of the two.
Okay.
So, and then Glett sounds like it's a harsh sounding Chicago name. And, you know, there's a lot of harsh sounding, almost deliberately abrupt names, highly ethnic. And so, you know, it's fun to play with those names. They're not usual names.
Yeah. So Milo works for the Examiner. And
yes.
That's supposed to be the third paper in Chicago. And
yes.
I distinctly remember the name of our third paper that went under was the Daily News. Is that what you're basing this on?
No, so, you know, I'm kind of winging it, but I'm kind of winging it between the two. But there actually was a Chicago Examiner way back in the day, way back in the day. But, you know, I've got a good friend who's just retired, a Chicago Tribune reporter. And I got to know newspapering through him. And I got to go through Chicago Tribune Tower and meet some of the news folks and hang out at the Billy Goat Tavern and meet some of those guys. And you know, I got a flavor for what these folks were going through, more than a flavor. I got a real strong taste. And so I just kind of invented my own third paper.
Okay. How do you think that Thomas Dart, the real current actual sheriff of Cook County, would feel about the sheriff in the black cage?
Displeased. You know what? Dart comes across, perhaps legitimately, as being defensive and outraged. And, you know, and I have to feel for the guy, because I think I really think he's a straight shooter. There've not been anything linking him to the corruption concerns that are playing out right now in our newspapers and our state house. I think Dart has every reason to be angry. Now, I played on that a little, but really the character is not in any way meant to be reflective of Thomas Dart.
Okay. Let's discuss the Citizens Investigation Bureau in your book.
Yes.
It's a supposedly advisory-only group. Do we have something like that? And if not, why not?
There have been attempts to do that. There have been threats to do that when talk about wealth, when the wealthy folks of Chicago have said, hey, you know, we've got to do something about this. We've got to take matters into our own hand. Mostly they've been threats, but people with money know people in power, okay, political people in power. They are all on a first name basis. And there's a lot of truth in the supposition that the big shots that run Chicago run City Hall and run the police and run the run the fire, run politics and stuff, because politics needs money. You know, they have an incredible hunger for money, the politicians. They need it. And so, you know, we've always been known for that. And so because of that, you know, where there hadn't been, there was something, I want to say probably 30, 40 years ago, where there were threats of forming something, and there was this and that. And in some of my research for other stuff, I had come across, you know, mumblings and murmurings of that and stuff. But it was quashed to a degree. But these guys, you know, the heavy guys are going to say, hey, you know what? We got to get this under control. I mean, I'm sure that's happening now with the disruptions we're seeing in Chicago's Magnificent Mile, you know, the high-end shopping district on Michigan Avenue and stuff. And you can bet that the people that have the money in this town are leaning very heavily on our mayor and on our new chief of police and all the rest of that.
Just want to point out for anybody listening that as we speak, we're on nightly lockdowns here in the city. Lakeshore Drive is closed heading south between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. You have to prove that you live downtown in order to get there. They're closing all the paths into the city, including public transportation. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of scary stuff, and it's not just taking place on the Magnificent Mile. It's
right.
Streeterville, Gold Coast, up to where we live, mm-hmm, in Lakeview. So it's a little bit scary right now, but people are angry, and there's much work to be done. So the Cook County Medical Examiner plays a role in your book.
Yes.
And I want to know, why aren't these crimes being taken care of by the police in the areas in which they occurred? Like, why is the county getting involved when a crime takes place in one of the western suburbs, for
well,
example?
Okay. Like, you know, for example, there was a murder. There was a murder in Hinsdale, which is a suburb immediately south of the wealthy suburb of Oakbrook. And Hinsdale itself is a wealthy suburb. A woman in her late 40s, early 50s, you know, suburban split level kind of lady, was stabbed viciously by a guy who walked into her home. And he took a couple of trinkets and I think an engagement ring or something, walked out and walked through the neighborhood and you know, hopped on the train, I believe, and went to another suburb closer to the city and pawned the diamond ring. Now, the Hinsdale police are not equipped, like most of the suburban forces, to handle something like that. I mean, they would use county people, like for forensics examinations, they would use the state police, perhaps. They need to bring manpower in, you know, on something like that. And that's pretty normal and pretty understandable. Mm-hmm. So they need to rely on greater resources than they could afford to fund in a suburb.
Makes sense. I've got to commend you on your very sensitive portrayal of the women. There's a stunner or two, but others are just the kind of women we all run into all the time. To what do you credit your approach to describing women?
You know, I have to say that I was raised by a strong, marvelous woman and a great dad, but my mom was a force to be reckoned with. I had the wonderful good fortune of marrying a phenomenal woman, a smart woman, a purposeful woman. I am a widower now, but she was impressive. She was one of the top business executives in Chicago, but yet she was a marvelous mom too. And a good friend and she put up with a lot of things, a lot of wild ideas on my part, most of which I was lucky enough to see reach fruition. But she was a very confident woman. So my experience with women, such as it's been, has been wonderful. I have known great women, and I am the father of a wonderful daughter. And a very strong-willed, purposeful woman, you know, a seasoned pro, lives in Brooklyn, works in Manhattan. She writes, but she's, you know, also very good at marketing and at pretty much anything else she attacks. So it's been my experience that women are just wonderful and to be greatly admired.
It was refreshing. You tell the story of how after the two girls are found, law enforcement and the family receive all kinds of ridiculous reports from people who say that they witnessed something or other. Why are people so horrible that they would meddle in an investigation with made-up stories just to distract the police?
You know, the unfortunate thing I have learned about the aftermath of crimes, especially crimes that have not been solved, is that the loons come out of the woodwork. And, in real life, in the 1956/1957 murder of the two teenage girls, the abuse that their mother had to take from all kinds of false leads. And I think about one in particular that's haunting. She was told to bring, $1,000 to a church in Milwaukee. And this is a relatively poor woman with four kids living in her house and a husband not around. And so she gathers up the dough. She's told that she shows up at this church, that one of her daughters would come there, collect the money, bring it back to the captor of the other daughter, give him the money, and then both girls would be free. So this mom, this Chicago babushka, okay, gets her $1,000 and she gets on a bus and she goes to Milwaukee and she sits in a church for hours. And nobody showed. Now, I can't imagine the mind that would formulate such a tip. But they're out there. And, you know, when they say, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, well, there's a lot to that. And, you know, stories like that, I mean, you talk to the police, you talk to, you know, criminal lawyers and stuff, and they can keep you engaged with such horrible tales for hours.
Yeah. As I mentioned, we're on nightly lockdown right now, and we've had way too many murders, way too many kids yes. dying. Not just Chicago, all over.
Right.
But Chicago. I'm wondering, do you think murder mysteries in which the villains are always caught are healthy or dangerous for us right now?
I think murder mysteries where the villains are always caught are necessary. I pitched an idea to my literary agent several years ago, and it ultimately resulted in a book. But it was a case that I got interested in because back in 1948 in Oregon, Illinois, a 17-year-old girl and a 26-year-old guy were on Lover's Lane. He was found the next morning, shot several times, and hauled into the corn beside Lover's Lane. She was found 4 days later under the only tree in a field. This became a national sensation, this case, by the way. She was then buried. The mayor of the town, 50 years later, started pushing to have her exhumed. She was exhumed, and they took a quick look at her in the sheriff's garage in the town square, the county courthouse in Oregon, Illinois, and the mayor runs up, looks in the casket, and said, "That's not her head." She'd been buried with someone else's head. Now, that case was never solved officially. I pitched the idea to my agent, and he said, if you're going to write the case, you got to modernize it, and you've got to say who done it. And, you know, because a reader is not going to get to the end and say, well, who did it? I don't know. So, you know, so there has to be closure in fiction, mm-hmm. and it's so much lacking in real life.
Yeah. Ah, so interesting. Well, you did touch on a lot of these issues in the book. It was really kind of a page turner.
Thank you.
So I'm wondering, what are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a couple of continuations. I'm working on a follow-up to The Black Cage, a sequel to it. Because Milo Riggs still interests me. He's a dark guy, but I want him to come into more of the light. And then I'm afraid I can't help myself from doing another Dick Elstrom book. Because, as I mentioned, it's an ensemble cast, and they are all crazed in one form or another, moderately. But they're great fun, and I like to giggle. And so when I'm writing it, and so I'm going to work on one of those. And then there are a couple of other things I'm doing. And I continue to do short stories. I've got one coming out in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in the fall. And so I like to fool around with new characters and new plots and new devices that ways too. So I'm kind of, I don't know if I'm multi-talented as much as just multi-distracted. And I'm going to do a deck book. I'm going to do a Milo Rig, and I'm going to play around with a couple of short story ideas.
And you're just going to skip sleeping from now on?
No. I read my stuff, and that puts me to sleep. No, I don't. I'm not that driven. Because again, my process is that I obsess and I go over it again and again and again. So, but then I have time for other things too. So, I'm trying to live this pretty full life.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure's been mine, Galit. Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host of New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Jack Fredrickson, author of The Black Cage, a Milo Rigg mystery. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle's an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.com/NBN/join.